Davao City Mayor Sara Duterte-Carpio insists there will be no Duterte-Duterte tandem in next year's elections. Presidential spokesperson Harry Roque claims the ICC prosecutor's report on the Duterte drug war lacked forensic evidence. Forensic pathologist Dr. Raquel Fortun will share insights on this burning issue later on in the program. The International Monetary Fund downgrades its growth forecast for the Philippines, citing the effects of the pandemic. And Californians rejoice as the state reopens and lifts most of its COVID-19 restrictions. We'll get a live update from our correspondent, Steve Angeles. Hi, I'm Carmina Constantino. Dateline Philippines begins right now. Hey, thanks for joining us. For those of you watching us on YouTube and on Facebook, I'm glad you could join us today. We're going to begin with this story. President Duterte's daughter, Davao City Mayor Sara Duterte-Carpio, insists a Duterte-Duterte tandem with her father in the 2022 elections, that is not happening. She is even unsure if she will seek the presidency in the first place. Archie Cruz has this exclusive report.
For presidential daughter Davao City Mayor Inday Sara Duterte, there's no way she will run for president in the 2022 elections with her father, President Duterte, as her running mate. This as her father's allies continued to push for him to run for vice president. Mr. Duterte is constitutionally barred from any other term for president. The chief executive had previously called on Mayor Inday not to run, insisting that the presidency is not a woman's job.
It will never happen na merong Duterte-Duterte. And then sinabi naman na yun ni PRD kung ano yung mga reasons niya bakit ayaw niya akong tumakbo president.
Last January, Mayor Duterte already thumbed down calls for her to run for president despite leading pre-election surveys. But now she admits she is revisiting the idea.
A lot of people are asking me to reconsider my decision not to run for president, and a lot of people are demanding to talk to me about it. I decided ako ng January, I was asked to extend it until April 30, and then by April 30, I was asked to extend it until July. So July, binigyan ako ng HNP governors until July to decide.
In the meantime, the names of defeated 2016 vice presidential candidate former Senator Bongbong Marcos and defeated 2010 presidential candidate former Defense Secretary Gilbert Teodoro have been floated as possible running mates following separate trips to Davao City for her birthday. Teodoro is expected back in July for his second COVID-19 vaccine dose as he got his first dose in Davao. There have been newspaper and billboard advertisements showing Mayor Duterte with Senator Sherwin Gatchalian, which hint of a possible tandem. But Mayor Duterte would rather think about whether she should even run for president first.
Well, all of them are my friends. Ang dami-dami kong kaibigan from 2010, from 2016, from 2019 na elections. So lahat sila mga kaibigan ko. Siguro mag-decide muna kung tatakbo ba talaga pangulo bago pag-isipan ang vice president.
Okay.
But I'm happy na ano sila, mga kakampi ko sila.
Mayor Duterte acknowledges skepticism that there is a political script that she will eventually run for president, as critics liken her to her father, who first demurred but eventually ran and won the presidency. But she denies there is such a script. In recent days, Mayor Duterte figured prominently in the news after a media exchange with Vice President Leni Robredo, who is considered to be another contender for the presidency. But Mayor Duterte says she has no quarrel with the vice president. Mayor Duterte explained she doesn't usually talk unless her name is mentioned. But this time around, she felt she had to speak up for the private sector and medical community of Davao.
Naiintindihan ko naman yung mga attacks against me, no? But ang hindi ko lang kasi matanggap doon sa mga sinabi niya is that yung private sector parang walang relationship with the city government of Davao, which is not true. Kasi dito sa Davao City, lugi-lugi na nga yung mga businesses, but they still ask us and they still go around out of their way to help the city government of Davao sa COVID-19 response namin dito. And yung parang ini-imply na inactive yung medical community dito sa Davao City, which is totally false. Kasi they have been silently suffering since March of last year. No? And hindi pwedeng hindi ko i-defend yung itong mga sectors na ito.
Very
Last weekend, Robredo had some advice for Davao City as it had to deal with rising COVID-19 incidents. This instead drew a rebuke from the local chief executive. Meantime, Mayor Duterte expressed the readiness of the city government of Davao to cooperate with the International Criminal Court, but only with the permission of the Department of Interior and local government.
Yes, if they need anything from the city government of Davao, we are open and willing to help, subject to the permission from the national government. So if the national government tells us, the ILG tells us, oh, Davao City, you open your, Davao City government, you open whatever document that they need, you send it to them. So susunod kami kung anong sasabihin ng DILG.
Mayor Duterte just returned to Davao City, but before she left, she confirmed meeting with Senators Aimee Marcos and Ronald De La Rosa in Manila. But no politics was discussed. RG Cruz, ABS-CBN News.
Another opposition stalwart sees Vice President Lenny Robredo as their strongest presidential candidate next year. Senate Minority Leader Franklin Drilon says Robredo could unite the opposition. Drilon, who is also the vice chairman of the Liberal Party, says all of their members will support Robredo if she pursues the presidency.
We are open to alliances. That is the reality of the politics today. As we said, we should have only one candidate. We cross our fingers that Vice President Lenny ultimately will decide to run for the president, and she can, we believe she's the strongest, and hopefully she can unite all the non-Duterte candidates. The opposition must go beyond an anti-Duterte platform.
Mm-mm.
The opposition must present a platform that says, we can do better. We can do better in the pandemic response, because these were the errors committed, and this is what we're going to do.
Presidential spokesman Harry Roque brands as fantastic the report of International Criminal Court prosecutor Fatou Bensouda on the Duterte administration's drug war. Bensouda sought a full-blown probe on the matter, saying crimes against humanity may have been committed. Roque says 85% of Bensouda's report is based off information from media and not on forensic evidence. The spokesman says these are considered hearsay. Roque adds the Philippines does not need the ICC to investigate the drug war.
It is only when local institutions, legal institutions are unable and unwilling that the ICC should take this decision. And as you know, we have a working legal system here. I was with the PNP chief, Eleza, yesterday. In addition to the initial 61 cases that they have forwarded to the DOJ, where they themselves found, let's just say, aberrations in the manner individuals were killed, they're willing to, in fact, turn over all the 6,000 files, no? Which involved deaths as a result of the drug war to the DOJ for investigation. Now, if that is not a willingness on the part of the Philippines to investigate, I don't know what is, no?
The International Criminal Court's outgoing prosecutor has spoken. Investigate the crimes against humanity that may have been committed under President Duterte's drug war. Malacanang says evidence presented were one-sided, provided only by the left. But forensic pathologist Dr. Raquel Fortun says she's seen many of the dead bodies in the flesh, blood, gore, and all. Dr. Fortun joins us now. Dr. Fortun, welcome to the program, and thank you for joining us today.
Good afternoon. Hi.
All right. So let's begin with what Harry Roque said. He said the report lacked forensic evidence, but let's begin with what you saw. What tales did those dead bodies tell you, Dr. Fortun?
Well, in the first place, I have not seen many of these cases. I've just seen some. Barely a handful, that's what I say. Because they don't get referred to me routinely, and I would not have managed, actually. It's very difficult. Until now, I still have cases unfinished because I really try and analyze each one. And you know, tell me what the dead are trying to say. And all of these deaths, we're speaking of thousands, even tens of thousands of shooting, violent deaths. If you actually have a first world forensic science-based death investigation system, you wouldn't have these unsolved killings. Shootings are not impossible to solve. They're actually great in the sense that you have so much physical evidence to work on. They leave a lot of material at the scene, even in the body, the bullet trajectory where it passes through externally and internally, you can trace that. And the science is there already. At the scene, you get bullets, casings, which can be matched fast. There's a technology already, automated ballistics, okay? Mm. And then in the body, this is where forensic pathology comes in, and that's my field. Mm. If only each body is processed, you know, the way it should be done. Right at the scene, you don't move bodies unnecessarily unless the person is still alive and you seek medical care. Forget about forensics. The priority is to save the life. Okay. Correct. These cases, rarely would you hear of a survivor being brought to the hospital. Bodies brought to the hospital are practically dead. So they were removed from the scene. That's already a big no-no. Mm-mm. Because you have disturbed the physical evidence. And what happens is they're brought to the hospital only to be pronounced dead. And then next is, so the body has to be examined. Everything, clothing, and then externally, internally, that's not done routinely. And that's what I try to do for the few cases referred to me. I try to reconstruct. I get them, the best scenario is I get them, I would not get them fresh. I get them already embalmed. That's another thing. Embalming, yes, it preserves, but it also destroys evidence. I get the gunshot wounds already sutured. So you have destroyed already the physical features that can tell you, is this entry, is this exit? So many mistakes done. Medical legal officers, they do an autopsy, and they just don't do it right. Sometimes there seems to be an incision, but there's no examination at all. Mm. Bullets are not recovered.
Yeah, so Dr. Fortun, whatever the state of the dead body is at that point when it reached you, For the few that you've seen, for the some that you've seen, what story did these dead bodies tell you, despite the state that they arrived in or the state that you saw them in?
The shooting cases I see, they're very complicated because they sustained multiple gunshot wounds, and generally, the perpetrators, the shooters, aim for the chest and the head. So they really meant to kill. And then sometimes I also get them in the upper extremities, in the hands. Okay? And this has a significance, the location. As I said, if you aim for the head, you aim for the chest, and then you shoot somebody several times, that is not an argument for, no, you're just immobilizing, you're just... Yeah, okay. It's not self-defense. Okay, you aim to kill.
Yeah, right? I was going to get into that because the phrase that we often hear is that they fought back. It was in self-defense, non-laban. So you didn't see, or did you see, any evidence that would point to that?
Well, indirectly, that's it. If you see multiple gunshot wounds, then the intent to really finish off, to really kill these people is there. And that's it. They aim for the chest. You're going to kill people that way. Vital organs are there. You aim for the head. You don't intend for these people to survive. Mm. And then the other thing that sometimes I get, the hands and the arms also have gunshot wounds. Sometimes the bullets are still there. And these are indicative of, because of location, we call them defense-type injuries, because it appears that instinctively the individual put up the hands and the arms like that.
To surrender or to defend.
And there have been cases where you actually see cuff marks, ligatures, so they were restrained. Okay, so how could they have fought back? And actually that argument that, oh, I shot him because he fought back. But you're a police officer. You're not supposed to kill. Okay? So
what if they say it was in the heat of the moment? And that's what they would say, right? It's in the heat of the moment. We needed to preserve our lives as well. And that's why they had to shoot them dead. What do you say about that?
Well, let's look at the statistics. How many times have they simply disabled, injured people, and actually these people live, right? And then there are also and other instances where the scenario is it's a by-bust. But how come the dwelling? Okay, this is where, you know, totality of evidence, the scene findings will tell you a lot too. How come the dwelling was broken into and there are signs of doors, destroyed locks,
forced entry? Mm-hmm.
Yes, forced entry. Actually, can you not use, on the other hand, you've got the victim dead and then you say, nanlaban eh. Hindi ka ba naman manlalaban kung pinasok ka sa loob ng bahay mo? Okay? But what I find crazy is they insist on the by-bus narrative when in fact there is physical evidence that the residence was forced into.
Dr. Fortuna, these forensic findings, though, were these part of the petitions, the cases that were filed before the ICC?
I'm not sure if my cases were there. I wouldn't know. I might have been asked already. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I know of a lot of groups doing investigations. I know the Commission on Human Rights is also.
Yeah. So for Harry Rocket to say that there's no forensic evidence, that report lacked forensic evidence.
Well, I have not seen that 57-page report yet, but I doubt if they did not consider forensic evidence. Or actually, that's the argument. There's no forensic evidence used in these death investigations, and that is where complementarity comes in. You know, there is failure of the local system to act. And that's what's happening. You've got killings. Practically every day, you've got people getting assassinated. And you have to solve these killings to stop them.
Yeah. Dr. Fortun, you're not the only one, though. You're not the only doctor who saw these bodies. There were other doctors as well, other eyes that saw what you saw as well. And yet they've kept silent. What do you say about that fact that continues to happen?
Well, this is, you know, the practice of medicine. You have to scrutinize it. We were sworn to do no harm. And that is something I've been arguing for, that even if a patient is dead, you should do no harm. And if you are a doctor examining a dead body and you falsely report something. I have seen death certificates signed out as natural causes, and yet, the victim obviously died of a violent way, was shot. Okay, I have heard of horrible stories of victims making it to the hospital injured, but not attended to, so they die of their injuries. You know, that cannot be right. Or you've got victims brought to the hospital and then the shooter, the perpetrator, simply walks in and then finishes him off. And that's crazy. So routinely, unfortunately, at the heart of this death investigation system that we are lacking, we don't have forensic pathology. And I've said it before, unfortunately, there are doctors you would say, who are complicit to the killings. And they have to be held accountable for this. This cannot be right.
Take us back to when you started seeing the bodies, the several that you've seen. When was it that you thought to yourself, you're dealing with something different here? What was it in these bodies that told you this is something
Yeah, for the record, I have been seeing these cases of violence administration after administration. Okay, and I started my practice, what, something like 25, 26 years ago. So I've been seeing these gunshot wounds, etc. But for this particular administration, if you're going to just focus on the so-called drug war cases, the first one was in 2016. And I have seen about a handful, 20 from 2016 to 2019. I'm seeing another set for this year, but apparently they were killed for different reasons. They were red tagged. Okay? But anyway, do I see a pattern? What I'm seeing is the utter lack of a death investigation system. It's been the same even before the Duterte administration. And I think that was taken advantage of. The fact that we do not have a system to begin with. The fact that our investigators actually do not know what they're doing. There's little forensic science in what we do. We lose a lot of evidence. What's kind of crazy right now is at some point, remember, bodies were turning up and then they had signs on them, right? Signs. They had tapes around their heads and so on. And whenever I give lectures about this, I say, it's like your shooter, your killer is taunting the investigators. In the first place, the bodies are left out there to be seen, to be discovered. And on top of that, you have these dramatic signs. Yeah. You have tapes. And if you have a society where forensic science is strong, if you're a killer, you wouldn't want that. Why? Because you're leaving so much physical evidence on the body. As much as possible, if you kill someone, you wouldn't want it connected to you. But for you to leave a sign, for you to tape, you're leaving so much of you behind. But then this is the Philippines. This is where you get away with murder so easily. So to me, it's so brazen that these killers would do that. Mm. And it's crazy that they're not caught. And for you to not catch the killers, you embolden them. They keep on killing. And probably that's what we're having right now, the spate of EJ case.
Dr. Fortuna, we have a few minutes left, but I do want to talk about the family, those that were left behind. How were you able to explain to them about how their kin died and how about the violent death of their kin? Was it difficult for you to talk to the family after the examination of the bodies?
Oh, definitely. I think that would even be more difficult than making sense of the multiple gunshot wounds that I see. You have to deal with them. You have to talk. And you have to balance. You know, you're a scientist. These are your findings. But at the same time, you're human as well. You never lose the sensitivity, the humanity, etc. You're dealing with people. Okay? And that's a difficult part, especially the most difficult is when you have young people dying and you're dealing with a parent. I think the youngest was Micah Olpina, the 3-year-old, the very young child killed with her father. And children are typically very difficult to handle in the sense that you imagine the life. And then when you deal with the loss, you talk with the parent. Mm-hmm. You know the pain. You know the pain. Okay? And the others also who lost teenagers and so on, the young ones. But it the pain, you know, the connection, that you don't lose it. Even if you're dealing with someone who's an adult, you talk to the wife, the husband, the children, etc. And that's it. The difficult part is how do you explain to them the violence. The violence that occurred. Okay? And try and minimize the impact a little. But at the same time, you tell them the truth. Right? So what I do is, okay, I try and explain. And then I just bank on the fact that all the details, all the gory details are actually in my report. Which they will probably find difficult to understand anyway, but it's there. The documentation is there.
Dr. Fortuna, I want to end this interview with a tweet that you sent out. You said in your tweet, "It's 3 a.m. and I feel like crying for the dead I've seen and their kin I tried to comfort. Thank you, ICC." What are your expectations now that there's been a request for a full-blown investigation into the crimes that may have been committed under the Duterte drug war?
I have a clear picture of what the ICC does, what it's capable of doing. Way back in 2003, I had a good fortune of being part of an international group. We were students in the Institute for International Criminal Investigation at The Hague. So we were actually there. It was a wonderful two-week course. Okay, so I know what the ICC does. And we're hoping that this is a very, at least this is one step forward. We've been warned before, I've heard this several times, don't bank on the ICC too much. Don't put all your eggs in the ICC basket. Mm. But I just recently tweeted, at least the eggs in the basket are still there. So at least it's one step, one big step forward. And we're hoping that somehow this, you know, something really positive happens. My most basic wish is that the killings would stop. Even with just this simple move by the ICC, would it not send the message to the perpetrators to stop the killings?
We're going to have to leave it at that. Dr. Raquel Fortun, forensic pathologist, always a pleasure talking to you. Continue to keep safe. Take care. And from there, we're going to take a break now. Up ahead, the U.S. state of California lifts most of its COVID-19 restrictions. And also later, another global lender slashes its growth outlook for the Philippine economy. Dateline Philippines will be right back. Stay with us here on ANC. And we are back. Here's still with Dateline Philippines. Here's another look at our headlines this noon. Davao City Mayor Sara Duterte Carpio insists there will be no Duterte-Duterte tandem in next year's elections. Presidential spokesperson Harry Roque claims the ICC prosecutor's report on the Duterte drug war lacked forensic evidence. The International Monetary Fund downgrades its growth forecast for the Philippines, citing the effects of the pandemic. And Californians rejoice as the state reopens and lifts most of its COVID-19 restrictions. Back with more news. The Philippines recorded 5,389 new COVID-19 cases Tuesday. That takes the country's total tally to over 1,327,000. some 58,000 are active cases. 118 more patients died. Over 6,000 have recovered. While coronavirus cases in the so-called NCR plus area have declined, the health department says it will still watch the COVID situation there while closely monitoring the spike in the Visayas as well.
Ito namang nakikita nating pagbaba sa kaso, lalo na sa NCR plus, ay tinatawag naming fragile. Ibig sabihin, magkaroon tayo ng mga super spreading events. It's possible po talaga na dadami na naman, no, magkakaroon tayo tinatawag nating spike in our cases. And that's why we're seeing the trends can go either way. It can go up again or it can really go down.
The ICU utilization rate in some Metro Manila cities under high risk or critical classification. That's despite the decrease in COVID-19 cases in the region. Treatment Chief Undersecretary Leopoldo Vega identified Makati, Muntinlupa, and Rizal Province as the areas struggling with their ICU capacity.
Low risk category talaga ang kabuuan collectively for Metro Manila. However, there are cities na medyo mataas talaga ang ICU rates, lalo-lalo na sa level 2 at saka level 3 na may konting not enough number of beds for their adjustment.
Meanwhile, medical experts are appealing to the national government to place Bicol under a modified enhanced community quarantine. They warn the region could experience a surge similar to that of India's if the current spike is not addressed.
Nakapag-usap, nakapagsundo na kami sa mga mayors doon po, lalong-lalo sa may Legazpi area, na talagang magtayo sila ng mga isolation centers and quarantine para ma-isolate kaagad yung mga positive cases nila. At sa ganun man, pag ginawa ho nila ito, bababa talaga yung transmission. Kadamihan ho sa mga nakikita nilang may positive for sa COVID, nag-home quarantine. So ito yung kailangan talaga ma-isolate sa mga quarantine.
Mandaluyong City begins vaccinating individuals under the A5 priority group or indigents. Residents who are listed as 4P's beneficiaries are included under the A5 category as well. Pfizer shots from the COVAX facility are being administered in the city's two mega vaccination sites. Only those who have registered online will be accommodated. Mandaluyong has so far vaccinated over 125,000 residents. Manila has also rolled out vaccination for the A5 priority group. The city opened 8 vaccination sites exclusively for individuals under A5. The city aims to vaccinate up to 8,000 indigent residents today. Senators grilled COVID-19 task force officials over vaccine prices during Tuesday's hearing into the Philippine vaccination program. Vaccine Chief Carlito Galvez Jr. and Finance Secretary Carlos Dominguez III refused to disclose the exact price of the vaccine, citing non-disclosure agreements. But they said the prices ranged from $6.75 to $27.59. That's around 324 pesos to over 1,300 pesos per dose.
In fairness, the price range given by Secretary Dominguez is within the range of what we know to be the worldwide pricing. I am in the opposition. Let me commend Secretary Dominguez and Secretary Galvez, because I do not see the traces of the sticky fingers. That at the start of this pandemic, a lot of talk about overpricing of the PPEs and the favoring of the certain contractors.
Well, the U.S. state of California has reopened, rolling back its rules on face masks and other COVID-19 restrictions. It's been 15 months since it became the first U.S. state to shut down due to the pandemic. Our North American Bureau correspondent Steve Angeles joins us now with the latest from there. Steve, good afternoon from Manila. Yes. Nice to have you on the show. Go ahead.
Good evening, Casey. It's been a big day in California as the state has reopened following a 16-month shutdown. As of today, mask mandates and capacity limits have been rescinded in most situations for the fully vaccinated. Just a little over half of the state has been fully vaccinated. In Los Angeles County, there's about a 60% vaccination rate, making some people hesitant to shed their masks for now. Others, like Philam conservative business leader Mark Ang, has been yearning to take off the mask, and he celebrated today with a mask-burning ceremony in the Orange County town of Huntington Beach. While the masks are coming off, there will still be a need to hold on to them, as some retailers will have the option to require facial coverings. Some settings like public transportation, some school scenarios, will also continue requiring masks. Now, most scenarios will rely on an honor system where they're trusting the truly vaccinated people to be among the unmasked, while those who haven't been inoculated will continue wearing their masks. Carmina?
All right, Steve. Tell us about how fast the expectation is about the turnaround in the economy there in California after it reopens. What are the expectations, Steve?
So right now, they're expecting people to be back out, back shopping, a little more comfortable to also just be outside among other people. I kind of took a drive around today. I went to Huntington Beach where they had the mask burning ceremony. I peeked at some of the shops, some of the restaurants, and you can see that about 90% of the people there, and it was really crowded today being a heat wave. Business was booming in that area. There was a lot of people on that side of town unmasked for the most part. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, out eating, enjoying. You see a lot of people renting bicycles along the beach and just enjoying the day. On the other hand, I did stop by an indoor mall in the city of Carson. I looked at the sign. The sign gave people the choice. If you're unvaccinated, please wear a mask. If you're fully vaccinated, you don't have to. But it also came with a second sign that kind of gave the benefits of wearing masks. And from what I saw inside, even if it was an off hours, most of the people inside were still wearing masks. I saw a lot of people leaving the movie theater, which is another one of those places. It's a private place, but the movie theaters in this situation are still requiring masks throughout the theater. So we're slowly seeing people get back to normal. Speaking to some of the Filipino community, I describe them as cautiously optimistic. A lot of them were happy that we've reached this phase, but they know that because of the low vaccine rates, because of the 60% in LA County and the just over half throughout the state, they're not ready to be unmasked around other people who you're not completely sure if they are vaccinated or not, since we're not verifying whether people are masking or not.
Of course, the ultimate goal here is to keep people safe while reopening the economy. But as California reopens, how will this impact on the jobs lost in the state of California, Steve? What are the expectations there?
So with more people, with more jobs opening up, with more businesses reopening, with restaurants getting back to somewhat normal, you can see that people are indeed returning to work. The major amusement parks and even the baseball stadium today took in the first full audience. So that's 56,000 people. You think of it, that's thousands of cars coming in, that's thousands of people coming to the concession stands, and they will need people to service that large crowd. So, you know, within a few months, as more things do open up, more people are more comfortable to go out and about, we will see the return of jobs. Right now, because of such, some folks are blaming the generous unemployment and jobless benefits. They say that they've had difficulty actually finding staff for some of the lower paying jobs, such as the restaurant industry or another scenario. They say a lot of people actually left the restaurant industry or these other jobs that were severely affected to pursue other career paths. So we'll see those jobs fill up. Some places are starting to offer premium prices for employees to return. So it's starting to look a lot better, at least within this region.
All right. We're going to have to leave it at that. Steve Angeles there, North America correspondent. Nice to talk to you again, Steve. Take care. Keep safe.
You too.
Right, moving on, U.S. President Joe Biden arrives in Geneva ahead of his first summit with Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin. And as this report tells us, expectations for a major breakthrough are low, with ties between Washington and Moscow at their most strained in years.
U.S. President Joe Biden flew to Geneva on Tuesday, where he will, for the first time since taking office, meet face-to-face with Russian President Vladimir Putin. This meeting of rivals comes as relations between Washington and Moscow are at their most fraught in years. But both leaders say they hope the summit at a Swiss villa can lead to a stable and predictable relationship between the two powers. In Brussels, ahead of the sit-down, Biden laid out his approach to the Russian leader.
I'm going to make clear to President Putin that there are areas where we can cooperate if he chooses.
In an interview with NBC News, Putin held out the possibility the two nations could find areas of agreement.
We have a bilateral relationship that has deteriorated to what is the lowest point in recent years. However, there are still matters that need a certain amount of note comparing, identification, and determination of mutual positions so that issues of mutual interest can be solved more effectively to the benefit of both the United States and Russia.
Despite cautious optimism, expectations for a major breakthrough are low.
I'm not looking for conflict with Russia, but that we will respond if Russia continues its harmful activities.
The U.S. blames Russia for election interference and cyber attacks on American businesses. The White House accuses the Kremlin of military intervention in Ukraine, where Russian-backed separatists battle forces loyal to American allies in Kyiv. And Biden has criticized Putin for allegedly poisoning and then jailing the Russian dissident Alexei Navalny. Russia adamantly denies these accusations, and Putin shrugged them off.
We know it all well. We have been accused of all kinds of things, election interference, cyber attacks, and so on. And not even once did they bother to produce any kind of evidence, just baseless accusations.
The acrimony between the sides isn't new. The two men met a decade ago when Biden was vice president and Putin was prime minister. And both men belie a begrudging respect for one another. Putin compared Biden with his predecessor.
President Biden, of course, is radically different from Trump because he is a professional. He has spent virtually his entire adulthood in politics. He's been doing it for years.
And Biden offered this about his Russian counterpart.
He's bright. He's tough. And I have found that he is a, as they say, when he used to play ball, a worthy adversary.
A U.S. aircraft carrier group enters the South China Sea at a time of rising tensions between Washington and Beijing. The U.S. Navy says the USS Ronald Reagan, accompanied by a guided missile cruiser and guided missile destroyer, is on a routine mission. China frequently objects to U.S. military presence in the South China Sea, saying these do not help promote peace or stability. The announcement also follows China's blasting of the group of seven nations for a statement scolding Beijing over a range of issues. And take another break. Still to come, Kevin Durant powers the Brooklyn Nets to an improbable win in their playoff series against the Milwaukee Bucks. The latest in sports. When you return, stay with us here on ANC. And we are back with more news. You're still with Dateline Philippines here on ANC. The government relaxes rules on the use of face shields. Our correspondent, Katrina Domingo, now joins us to tell us all about that. Katrina, go ahead.
Hi, Carmina. That's right. Those working or walking in open air settings do not have to wear face shields. That's according to Health Undersecretary and Treatment Czar Leopoldo Vega. He says that face shields are needed only when people are in indoor settings such as malls and restaurants, or whenever they have face-to-face interaction. He says that the transmission of COVID-19 is very low, so those walking outdoors may remove it because, as we all know, these face shields have the tendency to trap in moisture and thereby may lead to some accidents or mishaps, especially for those who are on the road. Vega, however, clarifies that face shields should still be worn in closed spaces, closed public spaces. He says
Okay, we're going to have to cut the report of our correspondent Katrina Domingo there, but basically saying that government has now allowed that people not wear their face shields when they're outdoors, but it's still advisable. They're still advising that face shields be worn when in enclosed spaces. So again, that was our correspondent, Katrina D'Amigo. They're joining us on the line. Thanks, Kat. Sorry to cut you there. All right. Moving on to business now, the International Monetary Fund downgrades its growth outlook for the Philippines this year as various COVID-19 restrictions remain across the country. Let's get more details now from our correspondent, Warren de Guzman. Warren, go ahead.
Thank you, Carmina. The International Monetary Fund is the latest multilateral financial institution to cut its growth forecast for the Philippine economy this year. The forecast is now 5.4% from an earlier forecast of 6.9%. This is still more optimistic than the other forecasts, with the Asian Development Bank and World Bank forecasting growth this year to hit 4.5 to 4.7%. But all three are below the government's target range of 6 to 7%. The reductions of all three also showed they expect a bigger impact from the spike in COVID-19 cases in March and April than the Philippine government, which only slashed 0.5% off its previous forecast range.
We see a bit of a slowing in the recovery in the first half of 2021 before a pickup in the second half of this year. The slowing in the recovery in the first half is mostly due to the second wave of the pandemic, which peaked in April, and which necessitated some stricter quarantine measures and has also weighed on confidence. But now, hopefully, the second wave should be on the way out.
The IMF also warned that there are still significant downside risks to the growth forecast due to the persisting COVID-19 outbreak. One key risk is COVID-19 vaccine supply constraints, which could lead to virus resurgence and another round of tighter quarantine measures. Vaccine supply issues could also raise financing costs for the public and private sector. However, the IMF believes the current action plans of the Philippine government on both the fiscal and monetary policy side are appropriate.
Our view is the baseline fiscal policy as set out by the Department of Finance and then now just as per the latest May meeting of the Development Budget Coordination Committee. I think this fiscal program is appropriate, provides for substantial stimulus under the baseline. And as mentioned before, the program has all the three essential elements mentioned earlier. It supports the health sector. It enables the vaccination program for this year. It also the foundation for vaccination for next year is being laid. Second, it supports vulnerable households and businesses to some extent, increasingly targeted. And it provides demand support, in particular through the infrastructure program.
As for inflation, the IMF expects it to average 4.2% in the Philippines this year, higher than the Philippine Central Bank's own forecast of 3.9% and above the preferred target range of 2 to 4%. However, like the Philippine Central Bank, the IMF expects the elevated inflation to be temporary. Central Bank Governor Benjamin Jokno says inflation should ease as government efforts to address the supply woes created by the African swine fever outbreak are implemented. While multilateral lenders have largely lauded the Philippine government's COVID-19 response, labor groups and opposition leaders have mostly called for more spending. The Makabayan Bloc in Congress has been calling for more social amelioration or ayuda to help 4.1 million unemployed Filipinos cope with high inflation, which has averaged 4.5% from March through May. Philippine lawmakers are also debating the Bayanihan 3 bill, which has provisions for another round of social amelioration. Carmina, back to you.
Thanks a lot. Our correspondent Warren de Guzman there joining us on the line. Take care, Warren. Keep safe. Right, on to some sports action now. The Brooklyn Nets were down to one healthy star and faced a 17-point deficit in a pivotal Game 5. But Kevin Durant wouldn't let them to lose. The former MVP had one of the greatest playoff performances in league history as he lifted the Nets to a 114-108 win against the Milwaukee Bucks in their second round series. Durant had 49 points, 20 in the fourth quarter, and added 17 rebounds and 10 assists. No other player has accomplished those stats in NBA postseason history. Brooklyn needed all of it as they continued to miss the injured Kyrie Irving and got limited production from James Harden, who was still bothered by his hamstring injury. The Nets can close out the series with another victory in Game 6 in Milwaukee. And before we go, K-pop sensation BTS caps off its 8th anniversary with a new world record. It was able to rake in 1.33 million paid subscribers from over 195 territories in its digital fan meet event last June 13th and 14th. The impressive figure smashed the previous record for the largest paid virtual concert, also held by BTS. And that'll do it for today. Thank you for joining us. I'm Carmina Constantino. If you want to revisit today's episode, Dateline Philippines podcast is on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Play back this newscast too on ANC's YouTube channel and on ANC 24/7 on Facebook. Keep safe. Keep tearing ANC.